Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back. Now, Karen O'Connor joins me this morning to talk family, friendship and secrets. Her debut novel, Meeting May, will be out in a couple of weeks. And she's in studio right in front of me here now to tell me all about it. And of course, the people and the events in her own life that inspired the book. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Maura. Great to be here.
Now, Meeting May, that's what the book is called. Tell us about it. But tell us, I suppose, maybe before we chat a little bit about the book, let's go back to your own story.
Okay. I am a, I'm nearly 50, but I guess I had a working class background. I was born in Ballyfermot, moved to Palmerston when I was 5, and have had, you know, lots of experiences along the way, lots of great friends. I had a baby just coming out of school. So,
what age were you?
17. So just after the Leaving Cert, I discovered I was pregnant, and I remember telling my mum, my mum who's, she's probably at home ironing still. Hi, mum. she was ironing, and she was talking about my Deb's dress. My mum is a seamstress and she was going to make my Deb's dress. And she was saying, oh, we'll have to do this and that. And I just thought, oh, I have to tell this.
And how far along were you then?
About 10, 12 weeks. Yeah, yeah. And I remember breaking the news to her. It was late at night. My dad was upstairs in bed. And she said, you have to tell your dad. I was like, no, you have to tell him, please, please. And she went upstairs and heard that pumping of the feet, you know.
Oh, yeah.
My dad came down the stairs and he just sat down and he said, okay, we love you and it'll be okay and we'll help you.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You were lucky.
Very lucky.
You were very lucky. I suppose they were shocked though. I mean, you know, it's a blow to parents.
Oh, it's huge.
And it's a worry for the future of you and the child.
Yeah,
and all that.
Huge. It was huge. I mean, that was wonderful what my dad did, but it was still a huge upheaval for everyone.
What year was that?
I got pregnant in 92. Yeah. And I had
Even
Rachel.
Though it's not that long ago, it still was a different time, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, there was still one or two mother and baby homes they were winding down now at that stage.
But that puts it into context, doesn't it?
Yeah. And yeah. It was kind of a bit shameful. Now, there was lots. I'm not the first and I'm not the last, but it was still a bit shameful. And
yeah, there was still that stigma was there, I think, in our society.
Huge.
But you went on, you did your leaving.
Yeah, I had done my leaving and it did okay. I got into college, but I deferred it for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And then when the place came back around, or the next year came back, Rachel was a baby. I thought, well, this isn't going to happen financially or logistically or whatnot. So I applied to do a FOSS course, a secretarial course. And when I went
down... Good, very practical thing to do.
It was. But when I went down for the interview, the guy said to me, oh, you got into college. What did you get into study? And I said, electronic engineering. And he said, oh, well, why are you applying for a secretarial course then?
Well, you thought it was probably like a lot of people. It was kind of an all-rounder thing to do. You know, practical.
Yeah.
I suppose you have to be practical too. You
do,
have a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm sure I went on down that road in the future afterwards. But they were really pushing women in technology. And I did, I went on to an RTV training course, a radio television repairing.
Oh my God, when people came to fix our TVs.
Yeah,
goodness.
So that was brilliant. It was like, it just opened my mind to, I've always loved books and reading and learning, even school books, but loved that course. It was great.
And did you have to repair televisions?
Yeah. We learned how to open up the back and the big, huge tube televisions.
For a massive yokes, weren't they?
And videos and radios.
What about lifting them and all that stuff?
Yeah, well, I loved the course, did well at it. At the end of the course, I went for a job interview in a TV repair shop. And the guy said to me, that's great, you did well. It was kind of a task, fault-finding task. And he said, "That was great. Yeah, you did well there. Can you lift the telly now off the thing and lift the other telly back up?" And I just, it was the biggest TV at the time that I'd ever seen. And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I can't give you the job then."
Oh, no, after all that. And what did you do then?
I didn't obviously get that job, but I went to work in Intel and I worked on the board line for a few years on repairing motherboards and stuff, and worked shift, which worked well when Rachel was small. But then as she got to school age, I thought I'll get a more 9 to 5. And I did a secretarial course then, practical, and I went to work in admin. And I mean, I've been learning for all of my life. So I worked in a beauty college and loved the kind of aromatherapy and the alternative therapy. So I trained as an aromatherapist and a massage therapist. And
you've done
Indian
loads
head.
Of it.
Yeah, lots.
And you moved away with your husband because you didn't marry the father of your first child, but then you got married and then had two kids.
I did. I had, I got married in 2004 and I have another two girls, Aoife and Orla. And we moved to Oregon in the States with my ex-husband in 2013, just for 1 year. It was an assignment.
How was that?
Brilliant. Yeah. Yeah, I loved it. Loved it. And that's really when I'd been writing little bits before that. I'd had a few small reflective pieces printed in Ireland's Own. And when we were in America, I had the time. You know, the girls were going to school, he was working, didn't really know people. So it was like, okay, if you can't do
and
it.
And sometimes,
now,
you know what, being in another place, getting away from your own society and what you're used to, maybe your mind space was there, maybe your head was ready to kind of absorb and then be creative.
Absolutely. I mean, Meeting May is set in suburban Dublin, and it was written, I started in America, I finished it when I got back, but really, yeah, that sense of home compounds in your mind when you're not at home. So it definitely comes to the fore more. Everything stands out more. You remember streets.
That's
and
very
the people.
True. Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like you have to go to an Irish bar when you're somewhere else.
I know.
And listen to Kaylee music where you'd never do that at home. Or you might never do that at home if you're not into it. And meeting May. May is an older woman.
May.
She's an octogenarian.
She is. She's in her late 80s, but she's feisty and she's fun and she's playful. And she's wise. She's a wise woman. She's lived her life. She doesn't have a lot of family there to support her. And herself and Susan meet by chance.
Susan is your heroine.
Yeah. Susan is in her late 30s, and they bump into each other. Well, Susan nearly runs her over at first, and then they meet again a few weeks later. And Susan kind of takes her under her wing a little. She sees May needs some help, and she decides that they should be the ones to give it. But they form a real friendship, and they trust each other, and then they tell each other their deepest, darkest secrets, and that's when it all kind of falls to pot a bit. And Susan,
without giving too much away, what is the main kind of, what is the main burden that Susan is carrying?
It's regret, guilt, shame, really. And then I suppose the main thing in the book is acceptance. You know, we all have things in our lives that need to be accepted, and we all need a really good friend to help us on that journey. And May becomes that.
Yeah, it's reflective. And you said it's reflective of your own life because in the book, Susan wants to have more children.
Yeah.
Even though she's married, she has two kids and everything's fine.
Yeah.
And that echoes your own life of what you call secondary infertility.
Yes. Yeah. It's a bit of, it's a bit different. I mean, I had three children and we hoped to have more. And we underwent fertility treatment. It didn't sadly work out for me, but I mean, it's that, you know, as a mom or as a woman, you have your children, but you feel there's room for more love to give that you might want to share with another little person. And you kind of, it's hard to explain to people that aren't there, because they, you know, everyone understands the need for a woman to have a child. But then when they want to have another child or another child, it's a bit like, oh, you know, why do you want more? You have some. So it's hard to quantify, it's hard to explain, but it's real and it's there.
And did people have that attitude towards you in your life?
A bit. I really didn't share that, you know, and I didn't feel that I could share it. And I was a busy mom, and I did have two small girls and a teenager, but I still really felt the urge to have another child. And I did meet other people that felt the same. Yeah, there was a bit of sure.
You know, have kids already.
Yeah.
Why do you want more?
Yeah. Why do you want more? And then you do, so you feel.
But it's a very personal thing. I mean, you can want what you want.
Exactly.
You're an individual, but still people were a bit, yeah.
Yeah, a little.
So it's an interesting take on infertility, because often when we talk about infertility, as you rightly said, there are people who, you know, are trying very hard to have one child.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is very profound.
It's huge.
And I suppose in one way you might understand if those people would look at someone like you as if you've completed your family.
Yes, yeah.
You know, but yet, I suppose, look, we all want what we want, and that's it. In the book as well, when you think about a young woman and an older woman, we don't often have that type of friendship in society anymore in Ireland. I mean, the multi-generational living is something that's changed a lot. I mean, my grandmother lived with us, you know, my father's uncle moved in for a while because, you know, he was on his own. But it doesn't really happen anymore. People are busy, everyone's working.
Yes.
So this might give a different take on that type of relationship to people.
Definitely. I feel that May represents maybe that older aunt that you have that you know you should visit but you don't really, or that neighbour that you see going up and down the road on her own and you never see her with anyone. And it's, you know, the older generation have a lot to give us, and we learn a lot from them, and the crack can be mighty, you know. And I just wanted to give May a chance to shine, you know, as an older person
with wisdom.
Yeah, and heaps of wisdom. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
That's actually very true. I remember my mother saying to me that she didn't even begin to know herself until she was in her 40s. And another thing as well that she often says to me, which I think is so true, although we get older and we look different physically, our minds are the same. And our brains are always 25, really.
Yes, absolutely.
And maybe people don't realise that sometimes. Yeah. We don't realise anything. I mean, when you're 20, you think 40 is ancient.
You do. I know my girls, you know, they slag me all the time and they refer to me as older or old or whatnot. You
know, change that narrative.
I know.
We have to change that narrative. We're talking about Dolly Parton, 78, off on a musical adventure again in Broadway.
Yeah.
So I think it's a mindset. Tell us then how you actually got to writing, because I know you said you had a few pieces published in Ireland's Own, but then when you went about getting this book published, you were rejected a couple of times.
Oh, lots of times. You know, I mean, writing has always been there for me. I always wrote diary. I was telling your researcher, Susan, that when I was 17, my best friend moved to France, and we'd no mobile phones. There was no internet as such. So we wrote letters to each other.
We all did that, I think, in those times, really, and pen pals and all that.
Yeah.
But you had the book ready. So you went to the publisher and they were like, no.
No.
Why?
I sent out tons of submissions. You don't find out why. That's the heartbreaking thing.
Did they not tell you why?
Not really, no. The writing's good, but not for us, or just not for us at this time. Or actually, I see some potential here, but this is a tough market, and you know,
it's hard to know though how to improve then, isn't it?
It is.
Is that why you went to Maynooth and did the writing course?
Absolutely. So a few years floundering and meeting May was put back in the drawer, and I started working on another book. And then I thought, oh, you can't just keep writing them and putting them in a drawer. So I did
out of the drawer again.
Went to college, went to Maynooth to do the creative writing for publication course, and just loved it. It was like finding your tribe, you know, eventually meeting people with the same dreams and goals, and who you know, we're all doing the same thing. And the tutors were wonderful. And you know, just that having a group of people to share your work with, it's terrifying at first, you know, sitting down, having to read out your work. But that feedback and that push on, that kind of collective
feeling. Also probably a meeting of minds, as you said, but a sharing of experience, a sharing of work and how you work together, a sharing of what might come from the mind onto a page and how to do it. So, you know, I think for people even listening today, because they all say, you know, we always hear everyone has a book in us, but there are probably a lot of women and men like you out there thinking that they might like to write a book. So maybe a creative writing course is the way to go.
It gave me the confidence to keep going, to keep plugging away at it. Mm. And it gave me the peer group to say, what do you think of this? And really, you know, take on board the feedback, because it's a very trusting circle when you're in a writing course. You know, there has to be trust, and it's just phenomenal. I really enjoyed it, and it kind of gave me a bit more of the oomph to keep going. And I floundered around a little bit more afterwards. And then this year I just thought, you know, when you have one of those moments where you're like, what am I doing with my life? What do I really want to put my energy into? And I thought, I'm going to get this book out.
You just probably had to finesse what you already knew and what was there.
Yeah.
Interesting people getting in touch here with us. Karen, about what we talked about secondary infertility. Like, Karen, you were trying to have a child in your 30s after having other kids. Had the same experience as Karen, had two children. I decided to have a third in my late 30s. Shocked to find that I couldn't get pregnant. Went for fertility treatment. Eventually had another baby. But the judgment of other people and the things they say was very upsetting.
Yeah.
So you're not the only one.
Yeah, no. And that's the thing, you know. So I tended to just keep it on the down low, keep it to myself. Of course, now it's out there a bit in a book. But
and there's no harm that it's out there, because it's giving you the inspiration to write the book, and it's put a spotlight on something we don't talk about. And also, I think I love the fact that the best friend in the book is a woman who's an octogenarian, and the wisdom and all that comes from that. It's been a pleasure to meet you, Karen.
It's been great, and thanks so much for having me in.
You're
really
very
great.
Welcome. When can we see the book on the shelves?
It'll be out in early July, so about four weeks or so. It's available to pre-order already from Essence, but
And it's published by Poolbag,
yeah.
Meeting May. And it's by Karen O'Connor. Thanks a lot, Karen.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Email oliver@rte.ie.